Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Three individual case studies where families lost people, but we're at that very early stage of the pandemic, we're talking kind of late March, early April.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, imagine being told that, you know, Minister, there's a virus on its way, and it's likely that tens of thousands of people could die.
From the news team at Virgin Media Ireland, this is Room 631, Ireland's COVID crisis. I'm reporter Zara King. This six-part podcast series contains the unheard tapes from the Virgin Media News documentary team. These episodes come from hours of footage taken during the making of our documentary, Ireland Under Lockdown. Throughout the series, we'll hear the thoughts of key decision makers who sat inside the walls of Room 631 at the Department of Health, and the voices of the people whose lives were changed by those decisions as a global crisis unfolded in their homes.
Okay, Rose, you're happy. Obviously, you're ignoring the camera.
No problem. I will never forget Dr. Tony Hoolan and others briefing me and Leo as Taoiseach at the time about the potential impact in terms of death and illness in our country. I mean, hearing figures that ran to tens of thousands. I mean, imagine being told that, you know, Minister, there's a virus on its way and it's likely that tens of thousands of people could die in our country. And there's no vaccine, there's no effective treatment, and we don't know a huge amount about it yet. And, you know, being in a department where plans were being made to expand mortuary facilities, set up field hospitals, taken over hotels like City West. I remember standing out there in City West. Again, all the days run into one, but I remember standing out there in City West in, you know, the big massive conference hall where, you know, someone like me would usually be there for a party conference or an exhibition or to give a speech. And, you know, this place being turned into what would effectively have been our field hospital. And I remember on the one hand thinking, wow, fair play to the HSE for getting this ready and being so organised. And then on the other hand, I remember leaving and getting back in my car and just feeling so uneasy. The idea that this could be a reality, that shortly this facility could be full of very, very, very sick people from a virus that we were still learning so much about. Now, thankfully, for all the reasons that we know, that didn't come to pass.
And it was such a daunting prospect for all of us. But for you as the health minister, were you frightened at any point?
Yeah, I was really worried. I was very, very assured that we were in good hands. I mean, Dr. Tony Hoolan, much commentary about the man, his demeanour, his sense of calm, his sense of authority, his assertiveness, was something that was hugely reassuring to me as health minister. But I was very worried because people were asking questions and people were seeking assurances that I was not able to give them. So, you know, I mean, it's that sense of powerlessness. So, we couldn't stop the virus coming. We couldn't cure the virus. We couldn't buy a medicine to make people better. So what could we do? We could try and alter people's behaviour. We could try and teach each other how to live safely. We could try and teach each other the things to do to keep ourselves and our families and our loved ones safe. And that's really what we put all our energy into. And I'll always be grateful, and I think we should always be grateful as a country, to the fact that Tony, Nefesh, the HSE, everybody got on board with that. You know, so instead of feeling powerlessness, we started to focus very, very quickly on what could we do, and trying to communicate with people in a very honest way. So actually saying, as I would have had to say to you on many occasions, we don't know the answer to that question, but here's what we do know. And I think that was important because I remember Tony saying to me at the start, the communications during a public health emergency becomes vital. And it really did, because if there had been a moment in time where the Irish public had have stopped listening, stop listening to Dr. Hoolan, stop listening to the Department of Health, stop listening to me, it would have been almost impossible to get out the messages that we needed to get out to save lives.
So we had, that was the preliminary stage and we could see it coming. And then eventually, the 29th of February, we have our first confirmed case. Talk us through that day for you. What were you doing? How did you find out? Give us a sort of...
So this was a Saturday, I think, because I remember being at home. And I remember sitting on my couch. I think I was home alone. And I remember my phone ringing. And I just looked at it. Oh, Tony Hoolan. And it was... I'm going to guess half three on a Saturday afternoon, sometime around then. And, you know, I didn't think Tony was ringing to see he was having a nice weekend at 3:30 on a Saturday. So I obviously immediately answered his call and he said, I'll never forget, he said, Minister, you know what I'm ringing about, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he then obviously briefed me on the situation that we now had our first confirmed case. Of course, before that, we'd had the case in the north that had come through Dublin. But at that stage, we'd had our first confirmed case. And it's actually fascinating. If you think about all of the... I say this respectfully, but if you think about all of the media questions and the public questions at that stage, where is it? Who has it? Are they a man? Are they a woman? Are they 40? Where do they live? You know, did I meet them? Because we were talking about a single case. And then for the next number of days, we were talking about more single cases. And if you think of that now in the context of so many tens of thousands of cases. And I remember, Tony, it was a difficult time, actually, because everybody wanted to know, who has it? You know, where do they live? Do they live near me? Are they a man? Are they a woman? And we obviously couldn't reveal that because we had to protect the identity of the person. At the end of the day, they have a right to have their medical information protected between them and their doctor. And secondly, we needed people to continue to come forward. You didn't want to have a frenzy around every time somebody got COVID, because that would have actually meant that if I had a symptom, I wouldn't have come forward for a test.
And when you got that news, were you shocked or were you somewhat relieved that all the preparation, almost the anticipation, some said, of it coming was nearly more of an anxious time, that when it arrived, there was a bizarre relief to it?
Yeah, I suppose I was still shocked because, I mean, shocked was kind of a stupid way to be, but because I was always going to come here. Like, there was an inevitability about its arrival. And you're right, there was this massive kind of build-up to its arrival where day in, day out, we were trying to tell people about COVID-19, it's coming to Ireland, it's very dangerous, here's what you need to do. But there hadn't been any cases. But still, you know, when it actually happens, when you hear, this is real now, it's here. And considering we knew that once we got one case, we were going to get many cases. And you got to remember, at that time, I was seeing projections that were very dire. Very, very dire in terms of how many people could have gotten sick and how many people would have lost their lives. And of course, sadly, there was lots of tragedy and lots of pain in Ireland, and every single loss was devastating. But I can only tell you that the level of death that we could have seen in our country at that stage based on the projections was just so high, it was almost impossible to comprehend.
And it was those first sort of 2-3 weeks where a lot of big decisions were made. Our lives changed in those first 2-3 weeks. What we knew as normal life had completely changed. Do you remember the conversations that were happening once we realised first cases in contingency planning? What would we do next? Can you talk us through some of the conversations that were happening at a government and at a health level?
Yeah, so I mean, the first conversation was about capacity. And again, as we've talked about, there'd been a lot of work done already in the background to build up that capacity. But the first conversation was to make sure we had all of the resources that we needed to absolutely maximise capacity. And look, all of this went on, as you know, for days and weeks. And really, I suppose it culminated in that meeting in March of NPHET that went on through the night. And I remember being briefed by Tony Houlihan and other members in NPHET in the big meeting room in the Department of Health in the early hours of, I don't know what morning, Tuesday or Wednesday morning of that week. The Taoiseach was in Washington. So Simon Coveney was then Taoiseach. I rang him, he came over to the Department of Health with me. And we sat there in that big meeting room up on the 6th floor in Museum Plaza, waiting for the NPHET meeting to finish. And it was then we were told by Tony and others that tomorrow, not in a couple of days' time, tomorrow, these things needed to happen, which effectively amounted to the start of the lockdown of our country. And I mean, you know, half two in the morning, leaving the Department of Health, back into government buildings, I'm not sure, 6-7 in the morning, to get ready for the Taoiseach, who again is in a different time zone in Washington, to make an address to the people of our country, to be then followed by a cabinet meeting, and all to happen in jig time. As even talking about it now, it's hard to actually believe how quickly these things happened. You know, that we had gone from a stage of me sitting on my couch that Saturday getting the call from Tony saying, you know what, I'm ringing you about, there's a case here, to sitting in the Department of Health in the early hours of a March morning getting ready to shut down our country. And I remember looking at it, and I remember saying it to my team, when you're in the Department of Health, it's as you know better than most because you nearly live there, when you're in the Department of Health, it's all glass, so you can look out and you can see out very far. And I'll always remember looking out of that meeting room that night and seeing all the lights in the distance and thinking they're people's homes and they're in bed and they're asleep and they don't know that we're sitting in this room deciding tomorrow that we're closing their business, that they're not going to be able to go back to work, that the kids aren't going to be able to go to school. But we're doing it to save lives. And I just thought of, oh yeah, I always remember looking out at all those lights and thinking, how are we going to tell people this tomorrow?
Because it changed all of our lives. It was the moment that changed our lives in so many ways, wasn't it?
It did.
Dr. Hulin talks about how that was that meeting and that was the closing down the schools, and then he talks about how they had to go back to the well a couple of days later.
Yeah,
so you see him coming back a few days later to ask you to tighten things up again.
Twice in that week we had very significant effort recommendations. So the all-night meeting that went into the early hours, that effectively was the beginning of lockdown, starting with the schools. And then very quickly they decided, and I think this was right, like within 24 or 48 hours, this in and of itself wasn't going to be enough. And that Friday night, I remember standing in the government press centre with the Taoiseach and Tony. And that Friday night, effectively, the lockdown was in it. But you know what? I keep thinking about this in recent weeks. At that time, all of us, myself included, thought we were signing up for a lockdown of a number of weeks. And I wonder, did that help us as a people? I mean, I wondered, is that what helped us actually, you know, that we... I don't know about you, but I can think in weeks. Do you know what I mean? How are we going to get through the next couple of weeks? I wonder if we had told people in March, we'd still be talking about COVID in December. You know, I'm not sure how we would have brought people with us. So I actually think, you know, it was based on the best information available, but we were asking people to sign up for a number of weeks. I remember being told then at the end of that period by Tony Hulin, I remember having an initial conversation with him in the canteen in the Department of Health, where he kind of broke it to me gently that, you know, Minister, we're not going to be lifting these restrictions. We're going to need them for longer. And I remember being worried at that moment in time, because we'd asked people to sign up to, I mean, restrictions without parallel, restrictions that none of us could comprehend, restrictions that you'd never wish to impose on people in your own country. Except in the most emergency situation, we'd ask them to sign up for a couple of weeks, and now we were going to have to go back and say about that, we need to go at this for a bit longer. And I remember wondering how people were going to respond to that.
How quiet the streets were during that time. Because even I remember leaving the department every evening thinking, never going to get used to how eerily quiet it is. A car wouldn't pass. You wouldn't see a bird in the street. Like, there was nothing.
It was so quiet. And I used to remember walking pretty regularly from my department to government buildings, and often doing interviews outside government buildings, and sure, it was just a deathly silence. I mean, it would be you, the reporter, an advisor, and that was about it. It was just complete silence on the streets. It was eerie. It was really eerie. And if you think about it, lockdown two, as people have called this kind of pre-Christmas period, hasn't been the same, because it just hasn't been the same in terms of the composition. So if you think about it, back in March, you had to stay within 2 kilometres of your home. There weren't really many exceptions other than very essential stuff. There was no one in city centres, nor meant to be in a city centre, unless they were there for the most particular and essential reason. I always think that lockdown affected everybody, but it didn't affect everybody in the same way. So I don't believe there's anybody in our country, probably anybody in our world, who hasn't been impacted by COVID-19. We all have, in all different ways. We all have our own worries, our own challenges, our own struggles. The impact of lockdown on each and every one of us is different. And that's one of the reasons why, and you know, people sometimes kind of get a bit mocked for it and stuff, but I mean, one of the reasons why I was trying to communicate a lot with people and talk to people and, as far as you can in the middle of a pandemic, motivate people to pull together and to get through this and to look out for each other and to be kind to each other, was that I was very conscious, and still am to this day, that not everyone's home is a safe place, and that we're not, and that we're all fragile, that we all have a fragility. And I think COVID really, really stressed and tested both of those things. Like, you know, because I know there were lots of people baking banana bread and baking sourdough, and look, we were all doing everything we possibly could to get through, you know, a time when we couldn't really leave our homes, and that was great to see people kind of trying new things and entertaining each other in Zoom quizzes and stuff. But I was also very conscious that behind that veneer of people doing their best, minding each other, that there was real pain and real hurt, and that every time we made a decision, there was a real human impact. These weren't kind of abstract decisions. There was an immediacy to it. You were deciding tonight that tomorrow I can't go to work. And look, of course, without getting into the politics of it, we obviously had to do a number of other things to make sure people could keep food on the table and a roof over their head, be it, you know, social welfare payments, bans on evictions, those sort of things. And that was an important part of it, actually, because you needed to try and keep the social fabric of our country together if you were to get everybody to pull together.
And as we moved through March and April, the reality of this was that we were losing dozens of our own people every day.
Yeah.
And I remember even as a reporter thinking, God, if five people died in one day on any other story, it would be the biggest story that year, and we would talk about it for weeks. It would be the lead story for weeks. And it just started to become like kind of normal, which was really gross, actually. And I found that quite like shocking for you as well. I mean, in your position, seeing the numbers coming in every day, they weren't just numbers. They were families that were going on to plan very pared back goodbyes to people that really mattered to them.
Yeah, they did. And I think the media in this country did a superb job at reminding people of that fact, because numbers and statistics were being produced every night, but they weren't numbers and statistics. They weren't numbers and statistics. They were our friends and our family who couldn't grieve. And they weren't nameless people, and they weren't faceless people. And I still think we're going to have to come back to this as a country. I still think our country has gone through a very traumatic time. You know, put aside the fact that generally people think Ireland did its best, and I think that's a fair comment. I think, certainly from my experience, everyone in this country, be you an individual citizen or a person in authority like Tony Hoolan, everyone did their best and pulled together. But parking that, there's huge trauma. And, you know, if you, exactly as you say, if you think of that, like 5 deaths, 10 deaths, 15 deaths a day, a funeral with a closed coffin, a funeral where you had to decide which members of the family could go. I mean, just simply horrific. Again, I think we saw great kindness from people in our country. I know, for example, the Hospice Foundation and others came together and set up a bereavement helpline and kind of extra resources and supports to help people grieve. But I think at the end of all of this, and God willing the end is soon, I think at the end of all of this we need to look at how we stop and remember together and grieve together for the loss of thousands of our people from this awful virus.
Yeah.
I did. There was a bit of the commentary that I must say that I didn't like at all during the pandemic, which was the reference to how many people have died every day and how many of those people have an underlying health condition. And I don't think it was in any way intentional. In fact, sorry, I know it wasn't in any way intentional. But as though almost to say, well, they had an underlying health condition, they were sick anyway. And that just used to stick in my craw when I used to hear X number of people are sick today, but Y number of them had an underlying health condition. As though somehow or other that was less important that they'd gotten sick. That wasn't the point, I know, of the commentary. But I do think it must have caused hurt and pain and possibly offence to some of those families. Because a lot of people who passed away with COVID did have underlying health conditions. But it was our duty, our collective duty as a people, was to protect them and mind them. And in fact, even a more important duty when they were already medically vulnerable. So I don't think we should forget that.
And we spoke to an undertaker as part of the documentary as well, and he was talking about just, I suppose, it is part of our culture, isn't it? We're still into big funerals as a country. Do you think that we're forever changed, or do you think when some semblance of normal life comes back that we'll go back to that, or do you think this has kind of changed us?
Oh, I hope we go back to it. I mean, I actually think we'll appreciate the things that we perhaps took for granted. And I don't mean that in a flippant way about grief, but the idea that in Ireland we generally do grief well, that we do come together as a community, that we have the week, that we have the get-together, that we remember the person over a pint or a glass or something, that we tell stories, that we hug each other. I think it's innately who we are. And I think, if anything, there's a longing to get back to that point. I mean, I think one of the big things that has changed in our country is now an appreciation for so many of the things that we never even stopped to think about. I mean, that's one of the changes that it's had on me, is that actually the simple things, the small things, the little things, the things we took for granted, the people we took for granted, I think COVID has made us stop and think about all of that again. Like, I don't think, if something good is to come of this pandemic, I think it'll be in that space, that we're beginning to, I hope, individually and collectively reassess, what does a good life look like? What's success? My mum used to always say, success is liking what you do. And it's kind of true, you know. I mean, success is, it's about your family, it's about your community, it's about your sense of belonging. And I think COVID has done that. I also hope it's made us appreciate other people that we take for granted. Like, we were all saying, stay at home to keep yourself safe. Stay at home to keep your family safe. What about all the people who didn't stay at home? Because they couldn't. And I'm not just talking about the amazing people in the health service, because we rightly acknowledge them all of the time, but I'm also talking about the bin men, the postmen. I tell this story, but I just think it's such a good example of what an amazing country this is. Postmen and women, at the start of this pandemic, came to us and said, we know where the older people live. We know where the vulnerable people live. We call to their houses every day, dropping off the letters. How can we help? And they offered. They didn't ask for a change of terms and conditions, nothing. Just out of sheer kindness, they offered to knock in on, call in a socially distanced, safe way, you know, the older person living in the community, to see if they needed a prescription picked up in the pharmacy or a few messages dropped in. I mean, that's who we are. So all of those people that perhaps we've taken for granted for years, I hope we'll stop and never do that again.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I want to move on to nursing homes, because obviously we know that they were severely impacted. Again, at what stage did you kind of realise things in nursing homes were really serious and that they were going to need a lot more help?
So I can't put a specific date on it, but it became very clear very quickly that our nursing homes were in a very bad way. I want to just be careful what I say here, because I know of many, many, many really good nursing homes. People who did everything right, for want of a better phrase. People who followed all the infection control guidelines, people who looked after their staff, people who looked after their residents, and COVID still got in. So I wouldn't like any of my comments to be seen as critical of people doing their best out there, because this is a highly, highly, highly infectious virus. And if it gets in, it's almost impossible to keep it out. Now, I think every day, and I probably will think every day for the rest of my life, could we have kept the virus out? How did you keep the virus out? How could you have kept the virus out of nursing homes? And And people would say to me, and these are fair comments, people would say, well, if we could have tested everybody in the nursing homes earlier, that would have helped. I absolutely believe that. But you have to also remember, we lived in a country, and we weren't alone in this as a country, that didn't have the infrastructure to do that. People like Paul Reed moved mountains, I mean mountains, to get PPE to private nursing homes. And again, I don't mean this about public versus private, but to private nursing homes that the HSE never had had a history of needing to provide things for because they were private nursing homes. But being honest, and again, I don't say this in a critical way about nursing homes, what I've learned from this though, and some people might say we should have learned it before, and maybe that's a fair comment, the model of how we care for older people is broken. You know, it is broken. Like, I'm not saying that in a highly critical way of people who work their backside off every day to mind people, to care for people, and do it with such dignity, and who risk their own health every day going to work. So I don't say that in any sort of critical way of them. But the idea that we build large buildings for you or I to move into because we've reached a certain age or a certain level of care, rather than actually saying, well, Simon, how do we keep you in your community? How do we put the supports around you in your community? We're not getting into a big, long health policy discussion. And that's what, when we talk about sláinte care and reform of the health service, that's what it has to be about. There are some countries that haven't built nursing homes, or certainly not many, in a very long number of years, because there'll always be a place for nursing homes. But this idea that care of the elderly is predominantly provided for in nursing homes. And then the second thing that I think is a very serious shortcoming in our system is the lack of linkages between the nursing home sector and the health service. And what I would say to people is, I really hope the linkages that have now been formed, they need to become part of the health service. They can't just be a temporary intervention. Never again can they disappear. And then look, there's real issues with staffing. There's issues with, in my own view, there's issues with the pay and terms and conditions for staff in nursing homes. I think that needs to be addressed. But there's also issues with, you know, there's a certain number of healthcare assistants, a certain number of nurses. The HSE wants to hire some, the nursing home wants to hire some, and you're still drawing from the same pool of people. So I think there are big issues. I think there are big issues about how we care for older people. But I also took it upon myself to FaceTime residents in nursing homes, because everyone was what was really annoying me as minister, being honest, was everyone was talking about nursing homes. So you guys were rightly reporting on nursing homes every night. I was being asked about nursing homes. We were meeting nursing home representative bodies, people who own nursing homes, but no one was talking to the people in the nursing homes. So I wanted to get a sense from them as to how they felt. So I remember FaceTiming residents in about, I'm going to say, 6 or 7 different nursing homes across the country, and getting to talk directly to them. And what was very clear was a couple of things. I mean, one, a resilience. You know, I remember talking to one woman who'd lived through the Spanish flu, and now she was living through COVID. I think she was over 100. Her husband was, or I think she called him her toy boy, in his 90s. You know, and I remember chatting to her, and I remember her very kind of matter-of-fact nature, you know, because she'd lived through the Spanish flu, she'd lived through hard times, and she knew Ireland was going to get through this. I remember talking to a woman who started crying to me on FaceTime because she was so lonely. And I remember her daughter had come to the window of the nursing home, and, you know, they talked through the window, and I think the daughter, this woman had a sweet tooth, and the daughter would leave some treats there, and they'd bring them in. And, you know, like, I'm, what age am I? I'm 34. You know, when you tell someone of our age that, you know, the next year of your life is going to kind of be disrupted or somewhat put on hold, that's one thing. When you tell someone in their 80s or their 90s that they're being cut off from their family for months and months and months, that can be really concerning for a whole lot of obvious reasons. So I used to think it was important to hear directly directly from them. But I just have to say, I mean, a highly infectious virus we see every year with the flu, it's almost impossible to keep it out of congregated settings. And that was, again, back to why all of us as a people needed to do everything we could to get the virus down, because the lower we got the numbers in the community, the less likely it would be that the virus would spread. But again, I remember people like Tony Hoolan being criticised, for want of a better word, for kind of, you know, why didn't you bring in visitor restrictions earlier? And you know, I fully support him 110% in his decision, because one, he was following the evidence, and I think the evidence is quite clear that he made the right call. But secondly, he was also conscious, as we all should be, of the human impact of telling somebody in their 80s or 90s or someone with dementia, taking away their support structure and leaving them in very good care but isolated from their loved ones. I mean, these were the really difficult decisions that had to be made on a daily basis.
One of the key questions, I suppose, in terms of nursing homes, though, was when nursing homes asked for help, did it come quick enough?
And I think that's a fair point for all of us to reflect on. My honest sense is that the Department of Health, the HSE, did everything humanly possible to support nursing homes.
But that's a fair point.
And they did everything they possibly could to support them as quickly as they possibly could. But back to my original point, would it have been much better to be able to test people quicker working in nursing homes? Without doubt. Without doubt. But we didn't have the testing facilities built up. So they had to build testing facilities that never existed before for a virus that we didn't know of before. And the moment they got to a point where they had that capacity, they started doing what they call serial testing programs. And that has, I believe, saved lives. Would I dearly love that we could have done that months earlier? Absolutely. Do I believe that it was possible to do it? No, I don't.
And so, in the middle of all of this then, we had a change of government, which had to happen. It was pending for a long time. Was it difficult for you to step back from being the health minister, or were you sort of ready at that stage after a long couple of months, or how did you feel about that?
I was resigned to the fact that I wasn't going to be the health minister. And in normal political times, you're meant to be delighted, apparently, if you're no longer going to be the health minister, because, you know, people make pejorative comments about how difficult a job it is. You're always in the firing line. You make mistakes. I made loads. And you'd imagine after 4 years, you know, getting to the exit and getting out should be a sense of great relief. And I'm sure in normal circumstances it might be. I felt a real sense of loss, actually. That again, perhaps I didn't realise I was going to feel. And not personal loss, I don't mean it like that at all, but just connections. Like, I deeply care for the people in the Department of Health now that I've been working on with this. You know, I don't see them in the normal kind of minister or official working relationship you'd have. I take a bullet for them. I know how dedicated they are. I know how exhausted they are. I know the sacrifices that they've made, and I know their names, and many of the Irish people don't. You know, they know the names of Tony Hoolan and Ronan Glynn and a few others. I know the near army of people working behind them to make sure Tony Hoolan can do his press conference every evening, to make sure Ronan is ready. You know, and they're also, you know, people that deserve our thanks and gratitude. And I just felt, and it probably sounds like a stupid thing for a politician to say, but it is true. I mean, I just felt a connection with people because it was different. Like, I wasn't the minister chatting to the public and trying to convince them that some policy of my party was the right idea or whatever. Like, it wasn't normal politics. I was just genuinely trying to authentically, truthfully talk to people, human to human, person to person, about what was going on. And very interestingly, they started talking back to me. So I used to get, I mean, a crazy amount of, and I say that affectionately, I was honoured and delighted to get it, but a massive amount of correspondence, letters, cards, mass cards, you know, little gifts to keep you going, like, you know, messages from people across the country saying you're looking a bit tired, keep going, messages from children, and they really stuck with me, actually. Kids writing to me, like thousands of children writing to me and, you know, telling me their views on COVID and asking me about COVID and asking me to explain to them why they couldn't see their granny, or also telling me, look, they knew why they couldn't see their granny and here's what they were doing instead to make sure their granny didn't feel alone. And yeah, I just felt so privileged to be in that position, to be an interlocutor, an interface, if you like, for people in this country with this pandemic and how we were dealing with it. And then when it comes to a sudden stop, And the pandemic is sadly still there and you're not, it feels different. But you know, we are in good hands, and we have incredible people working so hard for us. No country in the world can possibly get everything in a pandemic right. Ireland didn't. And when people sit down to write the history or the review, and there should be reviews into all of these things as to how Ireland handled the pandemic so we can be ready for the next one, and sadly there will be another one, people will find things that we did well and things that we could have done better. But what I will always know is that it was never, ever for a lack of effort or sincerity or hard work on the part of officials in the department, people in the HSE, frontline workers. You know, they left nothing behind. They left nothing in the dressing room. They did everything possible, and I'm very proud of them all. No, thanks so much for your time.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.